This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Parts of Georgia remain underwater today, the result of a storm that dumped 20 inches of rain in 72 hours. Colorado is bracing for up to 16 inches of snow by tomorrow afternoon. Who's ready to talk climate change? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Monsanto, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields without increasing demands on natural resources. More at ProduceMoreConserveMore.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 22nd day of September. Today in New York, we got something of a preview of the upcoming climate change talks in Copenhagen. Chinese President Hu Jintao gave a much-anticipated speech to the UN General Assembly, and he promised what he called a notable tamp-down on carbon emissions throughout the Middle Kingdom. Notable, but with no numbers attached. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports on what today's remarks signal for the Global Climate Change Summit in December.
Hu Jintao has four steps for how China will make itself more eco-friendly. He promises China will cut carbon emissions, though he doesn't say by how much. It'll plant more trees, use more non-fossil fuels, and develop a greener economy. Adele Morris works on climate issues at the Brookings Institution.
China is sincerely most focused on developing its economy.
She says Hu's goals all make economic sense. Energy-efficient manufacturing saves money, and reforestation could help stop some of the flooding China sees regularly. But with all that focus on economic growth, she says China may not be ready to put a limit on carbon emissions.
It's going to be hard for them to find a formulation of a commitment that they can live with.
Some people say that's because China's waiting to hear how far the U.S. is willing to go. We're the world's other big offender on carbon emissions. Eileen Clausen is president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. She says Hu wants help.
There is an issue of finance and what kinds of arrangements and dollars the developed world is willing to put on the table for the developing world. And then there's the question of what the major emitting developing countries are willing to sign on to in a binding international agreement.
It's a question the United States, at least, is still trying to sort out. The U.S. is still negotiating its domestic policies, and until that happens, it'll be hard to make international promises. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Every year, the Census Bureau gives us a snapshot of the American population. It's called the American Community Survey. Needless to say, the last year changed many things for many people. Job losses, declining home values, bank scares. They prompted us to spend less, save more, and make different decisions than we would have made just a couple of years ago. Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us some of the ways the recession is changing how we live.
The Census Bureau surveyed 3 million households last year as the Great Recession got underway. Back then, drivers were facing $4 a gallon at the pump. More people carpooled to work or took public transportation. Home ownership fell to its lowest level in 6 years, and more people over age 65 worked. Mark Mather is a demographer at the nonprofit Population Reference Bureau.
Everybody's been affected by this recession in some way or another, and what we're seeing is some of the ways in which families are coping with this new economic reality.
Another sign of the new reality, after rising steadily for years, the percentage of foreign-born residents fell last year. The Census Bureau's Scott Bogus says when the economy goes into a recession, immigrants are among the first people to lose their jobs.
That's the speculation, that economically the United States would be a less appealing destination or new migrants, or a less appealing place to stay for foreign-born individuals who had come here seeking work.
The survey was conducted throughout 2008. Margaret Sims at the Urban Institute points out that was before unemployment really took off.
I would say you can see bad things coming, and we might expect that next year's data will reflect more fully the effects of the recession.
So this time next year, we might have a better idea of where we are right now. By then, many economists expect the recession will be over, if it isn't already. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a weak dollar prompted investors to pump up commodities like oil and gold, and related stocks followed suit. We'll have details when we do the numbers. In the years since the financial collapse, a whole lot of money has been handed out to institutions to prevent them from falling apart and taking down the world economy with them. The Federal Reserve, the Treasury, the White House, they all bailed out banks, insurance dealers, and car companies in a variety of ways. So this week we're looking at how and when the government might get paid back. First up, the $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP. Banks like JPMorgan Chase and Morgan Stanley have returned the funds. Bank of America says it'll pay back TARP money soon. Tony Sanders is a professor of finance at George Mason University, and I asked him to catch us up on where things stand.
Some of the larger banks are actually paying off the TARP money simply because most of them really would like to pull out. They've actually are posting some gains or at least have cut their losses. But some of the smaller banks just don't have the capitalization going forward right now to repay the TARP or the federal government at this point.
And, of course, car companies got a chunk of it as well. Are we expecting anything back from them?
Car companies did get a significant chunk, and the answer is no. I would not look for any money to be coming back from the car companies to repay taxpayers.
So we'll take a write-down on that one.
You know, in reality, it was just a bad business model. We shouldn't have done it. But I think in terms of the banks, as the market turns around, I think that the banks are going to show some really good signs of repaying the money.
Is it fair to say that the financial system is still dependent upon TARP funds?
For the short run, I would say the answer is yes. When you look at it, housing prices have stabilized across the country for the most part. I wouldn't say they're not going to fall further. Arizona, Nevada, California, and Florida are all going to be susceptible to further declines, because that's where the foreclosures are still going to be coming, fast and furious, at least for the next 6 months to a year. So the bigger banks are starting to stabilize. The smaller banks, on the other hand, who had a lot bigger exposure to commercial real estate and commercial loans, they're not going to stabilize for a while.
One of the companies that got a pretty big chunk of TARP funding was AIG. Is that company anywhere close to being able to pay that back?
How do we know? The problem with AIG is that's a company that was sort of, I wouldn't call it a shadow bank, but it was clearly an institution that was, you know, not monitored very carefully. As soon as the market stabilizes and starts to come back, which is showing signs of, AIG will stabilize. But if the market continues to deteriorate, you know, we are on the hook for lots of money with AIG.
So the short answer there is no, they're nowhere close to being able to pay it back.
I don't think so.
Is it possible at this point to estimate how long it might take for the government to unwind its involvement in the banking system?
Well, to unwind that size of a portfolio, which is essentially what TARP is, a portfolio of preferred stock, it's going to take years to get out of this. And that's if the market stabilizes now and starts to grow. And that's going to be, three, 4 years before they can actually realistically repay that. If the market lies flat or keeps on its downward trend, we could see this being almost like a perpetuity. It just won't be repaid. That's why there's such a big emphasis on getting this economy turned back around on its feet and getting the banks back doing what banks do well, which is, lending money. We need banks in the economy. And the more this hangs out there and doesn't do anything, and the more the banks are stifled with having to repay the TARP money, the less lending they're going to be doing. So it's in everyone's best interest to, turn this thing around.
Tony Sanders is a professor of finance at George Mason University in Virginia. Thank you so much for your help today.
Oh, thank you very much.
If you're craving the taste of watermelon, peppermint, or maybe clove with your smokes, as of today, you're out of luck. The Food and Drug Administration's ban on candy and fruit-flavored cigarettes is now in effect. It's the result of the tobacco legislation signed earlier this year by President Barack Obama. But there's a new product that none of the new regulations will apply to. It's called an e-cigarette, or electronic cigarette. It's basically a water vaporizer that delivers a dose of nicotine without emitting any smoke. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
E-cigarettes have been around for a few years, mostly in Asia. Now they're being shipped over here in increasing numbers to satisfy a growing American appetite for them.
There's probably in this country this year over $100 million in revenues that will be generated due to this industry.
That's Matt Salmon, a former congressman turned president of the e-cigarette association. He and others in the industry say the product is not meant to help people quit smoking. It's an alternative to cigarettes that doesn't produce secondhand smoke and doesn't contain as many harmful chemicals as ordinary cigarettes.
What we do know is that tobacco smoke or cigarette smoking kills over 400,000 people a year in this country alone. We ought to be looking at more alternatives to tobacco smoke for people and not less, because right now what we're doing isn't working very well.
A typical e-cigarette costs about $100, but the cartridges are about one-fifth the price of an ordinary pack of cigarettes with the same amount of nicotine. Corey Canaro tried e-cigarettes briefly.
I was looking for something that where I'm not smoking all the time, it's like an alternative, because I tried the gum and I've tried the cold turkey, and my wife could attest that that's not good for my personality.
But a report on the news about potential safety hazards caused him to go back to regular cigarettes after just a week. Khalid Nayar tried smoking e-cigarettes in his Manhattan office.
They eased the craving. I was able to smoke indoors, which was good.
But after doing some research, Nayar found the product hadn't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration.
If we can determine what, actually that vapor contains, and if it's not harmful for you, then I would go back to it.
And that's the thing. There's no hard evidence either way about the safety of e-cigarettes. And until there is, the American Lung Association wants the products banned. Here's the association's Vice President of National Policy and Advocacy, Paul Billings.
If they are to be on the market, they need to be demonstrated to meet the standards for a drug delivery device in this country, which is to be demonstrated to the FDA satisfaction that they're safe and effective.
Are they safer than ordinary cigarettes?
Who knows? These are drug delivery devices. Nicotine is an addictive drug. FDA has found ingredients that we find in antifreeze that are toxic to humans as well as carcinogens in the products in very limited testing.
The FDA wouldn't comment on tape for this story, but the agency says it has the power to regulate e-cigarettes. It wants all sales and marketing stopped until companies have applied for FDA approval. But e-cigarette makers have taken the FDA to court, and until the case is settled, regulation is on hold. Tiffany Ellis works for the company E-Cigarettes National. She says research from the UK and New Zealand proves the products are safe. And she says companies like hers are getting a bad rap.
A lot of people seem to think that we're just in this to make money, and we're not. Making money is not as important as the ideology of what you're trying to support, and that is freedom of choice.
She points to the example of her own grandfather. He smoked for 40 years and has no interest in quitting. She says he just wants to smoke without harming the people around him. The issue of e-cigarettes in the United States is now in the hands of a federal judge. A ruling is expected soon. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, how an old steel town crumpled.
50,000 people a year. So many people lost over such a short period of time. We really wind up calling it the vast Pittsburgh diaspora.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Bulls were back in action today after yesterday's mixed results. The Dow picked up 51 points, about 0.5%, to end at 9,829. The NASDAQ rose 8 points, more than 0.3%, to close at 2146. The S&P 500 gained 7 points, 0.2%, to finish at 1071. Seems today's rallying cry was Bon Voyage. Investors charged up the gangplank of Carnival Cruise Lines after the company predicted an increase in profits for the rest of the year. Shares of Carnival sailed up 4.75% on stable fuel prices and increased bookings. Yahoo announced a new rebranding campaign, $100 million to push the new slogan, "It's You." Investors weren't feeling the love. Shares dropped more than 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners continues its fall meeting in National Harbor, Maryland. It's all about tweeting. 140, the Twitter Conference wraps up in Los Angeles. And on September 23rd, 1962, television audiences got a glimpse at living in the space age. The Jetsons began airing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl. As bad as the job market is for everybody right now, it's particularly hard for seniors. There are now about 2 million unemployed people over the age of 55. That is double the number from a year ago. A study released today shows just how dire the situation is for America's older workers. And Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
The study was conducted by Experience Works, a nonprofit organization that trains older workers. It surveyed 2,000 low-income job seekers over the age of 55. According to President Cynthia Metzler, many participants live in desperation.
We have so many people, close to 46%, that when they came to us, they felt that if they hadn't gotten employment through us, they would have faced homelessness.
Seniors reported having to choose between paying rent and buying medicine. Their job searches often take a year, about double the time it takes younger workers to find employment. After she lost her job at an auto supplier in Michigan, 58-year-old Kat Brown was out of work for 2.5 years.
We wound up, my husband and I, having to sell personal belongings, family antiques. We were able to keep the bills up for quite a long time, but eventually the strain of that sort of fractured my marriage, and we went through a divorce.
She found a job with Experience Works, where she now helps train other seniors.
A lot of seniors have never touched a computer. You cannot apply for a job nowadays without basic computer skills.
She says older workers who haven't reached retirement age are particularly vulnerable.
I am seeing more and more people between the ages of 55 and 62 who cannot even collect early Social Security, with advanced degrees, who cannot find work.
Seniors may need to work because they've outlived their savings or the stock market ate their retirement money. Again, Cynthia Metzler.
The people that we surveyed don't anticipate retiring.
Seniors who don't want to retire but can't find a job risk depression or even suicide. Advocates say more funding is needed for counseling and retraining. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
In a couple of days, world leaders will gather at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. The agenda is likely to include all kinds of trade policy issues, with key discussions between President Obama and Chinese President Hu over barriers to trade. Commentator Dan Dresner says when it comes to things like tariffs, the administration is heading down a slippery slope.
We free traders are an excitable lot. If trade talks hit a snag, we fret that it is the beginning of Smoot-Hawley 2. Even though the world trading system has weathered the Great Recession in reasonably good shape. Recently, however, the Obama administration announced a decision to slap a 35% tariff on Chinese tire imports. True to form, free traders were incensed. But isn't this an overreaction? 6 years ago, when the supposedly trade-friendly Bush administration imposed steel tariffs, they reversed course after the World Trade Organization decided they were illegal. Won't the WTO eventually patch up this contretemps as well? I want to say yes. I want to believe that the system is pretty robust. Since Obama was inaugurated, I've been resisting the urge to reflexively shout protectionism. Unfortunately, I think it's time to start shouting. The tire tariff isn't your garden variety form of protectionism. Due to the 2001 agreement that allowed China to join the WTO, if any one member decides to impose safeguards on Chinese imports, other countries can immediately follow suit. And China already has plans to retaliate by raising tariffs on U.S. exports of poultry and auto parts. It doesn't take a genius to see how bad it could get, and fast. My real concern, however, is the nature of Obama's political base. Bush's steel tariffs fulfilled an isolated campaign promise to the people of West Virginia. With Obama, however, this dip in the protectionism pool feels like the beginning of something much greater. The AFL-CIO has described this measure as the president's first down payment on future barriers to imports. Unions are already demanding additional action against Chinese steel. All presidential administrations engage in protectionism, but the Clinton and Bush administrations could also point to ambitious trade agendas as well. Barack Obama has no such record to fall back on. Indeed, it seems clear that Obama will use trade policy as a payoff to his base in order to keep them behind his major policy initiatives, like health care. With the global economy in a fragile state, protectionism is a terrible way to build a recovery.
Daniel Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org. I mentioned earlier that the G20 starts Thursday in Pittsburgh. Well, a few months back, when the White House announced the city would host the most important economic summit on Earth, some in the media actually laughed. Many folks think of Pittsburgh as a Rust Belt relic that's been losing population for decades. Marketplace reporter and Pittsburgh native Rico Galliano tells us how those losses affected the city and how it's bouncing back.
Call me biased, but I say the best place in the entire universe is Jerry's Fine Used Records in Pittsburgh.
Jerry.
Rico.
How are you?
Slowly dying, being buried in vinyl.
Jerry's is one of the largest all-vinyl record stores on Earth. 2 million albums. And he's a living encyclopedia of classic girl groups.
That's the one I'm talking about. Who Do You Love? By the Sapphires. And I'm going to play it for you.
Oh, the song is painfully appropriate. Who do I love? I love Jerry and my parents who still live in Pittsburgh. I love the city's bridges, most in America, the tons of museums and parks. But in 1995, I left anyway, followed by almost every friend I had. We young hipsters were the tail end of a migration that began over a decade earlier, with steelworkers. Chris Bream is a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh.
There were a lot of steel jobs here, and over the course of a few years in the early 80s, it lost half the manufacturing jobs here. So 120,000, 130,000 jobs went away and went away for good.
Bream calls it one of the worst, if not the worst, job losses suffered by any American metro region in the last few decades. When the jobs left town, so did hordes of the youngest, most mobile workers.
50,000 people a year. So many people lost over such a short period of time. We really wind up calling it the vast Pittsburgh diaspora.
The diaspora left a gaping hole where the city's tax base used to be. It left Pittsburgh with the second oldest metro population in America, folks who weren't exactly culturally adventurous, which is one reason restless youngsters like me kept leaving and why Forbes magazine once ranked Pittsburgh the worst city in the USA to be single. There just weren't many young people around. Bream says in the late 90s, city marketers came up with a desperate ad campaign.
Advertising not to the world, but to ourselves. And it was going to be a character named Border Guard Bob, you know, dressed in a Smokey Bear hat, looked like a border guard. And he was going to tell you, young people, you know, why you should not leave Pittsburgh.
The ads never happened. And it turns out they weren't needed. Because right around that time, Bream and others noted that though Pittsburgh still lost population every year, the rate of loss was slowing. Bill Toland writes a monthly column for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette called The Diaspora Report.
This huge exodus left a much older population. Those people are dying now. Last 10 years, I would say, that is largely what's accounting for our population loss, not so much that people are leaving in droves.
In fact, the number of people coming and going is close to balancing out for the first time in decades.
A lot of the statisticians from around here are projecting population growth starting the next couple years and going out for the next 30 years.
In this town, that's headline news. But why is it happening? Economists have many theories. Pittsburgh's real estate prices didn't inflate during the housing boom, so young families may be drawn by the prospect of a home they can actually afford. But most agree the biggest draw is something called jobs.
This is our main office where we have mostly software engineers.
Kamal Nigam is a manager at Google Pittsburgh. The office is a far cry from the steel furnaces of the city's past. It looks kind of like a kindergarten.
Oh, there's a picture of Mr. Rogers, a Pittsburgh local.
That's right. So all of our conference rooms are named after various Mr. Rogers neighborhood characters.
Do you have a Mr. McFeely?
We do.
The office opened in 2006 and employs over 75 people. Apple and Intel recently opened offices in this same building. Why? Well, Pittsburgh became a steel center because it had coal and rivers. It's becoming a tech and medical center because of another resource. Its major universities.
You know, with the presence of Carnegie Mellon here, there's good critical masses of excellent engineering talent.
In the 80s and 90s, Carnegie Mellon University ramped up its robotics and software engineering programs. The University of Pittsburgh developed one of the top nonprofit healthcare systems in the country. Now, companies like Google are setting up shop to tap into all that brain power. Economist Chris Bream says the challenge will be keeping them here.
It's a tough question. Regions, you know, are all competing against each other in ways that they were never competing against each other in the past. Investment is hypermobile. It'll go wherever it's going to get the best return. The talent, the people, the population, they're ever more mobile.
And if any city knows how fast a place can go from boomtown to ghost town, it's Pittsburgh. I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, the rapper Eminem and Apple Computer are apparently making for a sour combination. The artist's music publisher is suing Apple over songs that appear on its iTunes library. Eminem's 8 Mile Style claims it never gave permission for the downloading of 93 of his songs. Apple says it did get permission from a recording studio, Aftermath Records, which Eminem is also now suing. The case is scheduled for trial on Thursday. 8 Mile Style wants a slice of Apple's profits from iPod sales. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 51 points, about 0.5%. The Nasdaq added 8 points, more than 0.3%. And the S&P 500 gained 7 points, 0.2%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Beed. Next time on the program, college kids can party and shop at Target.
When their parents come to town, they take their parents to the store because they know where it is. and it's now their store. So when you think about all these factors, it can really add up for the store.
I'm Tess Viglund. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.